Hello and welcome to the Car Trade Revisited, the podcast where we talk about our industry and why we love it so much. I'm Gordon McLeish. I've spent over five decades in the trade. In the coming episodes, I'll try to inform, entertain and remind you of the things that you've probably forgotten, the things that make us all carries. So come along and join me on my nostalgic journey. In my previous episode, I spoke about how I returned to the car trade that I loved. I thought it might be interesting to cover some of the good, the bad, the ugly, the downright weird vehicles that we were expected to sell back then before going back to reminiscing on my personal journey. The 1960s was a decade of great change, and the major vehicle industry played a major role in those changes. The decade began with the introduction of the iconic Mini and ended with the arrival of the homegrown muscle cars. The beautiful Holden Monaro, the Falcon GT, what a grunt car that was, and the Valiant Charger, that was a dark horse. In between came the beginning of the end of the preference for European vehicles, with the arrival of all the little Japanese cars. The major styling feature introduced during the 60s was the Coke bottle effect, in which the boot and the rear panels were swept upwards over the wheel arch, creating sort of a profile which did resemble a Coca-Cola bottle. The first Australian car to incorporate the Coke bottle hump was the XR Falcon back in September 1966. The styling of the car was sort of inspired by the Mustang, copying both the Coke bottle style line and a long bonnet with deep stumpy boot. And whereas the 50s were dominated by the British and the four-cylinder cars that they made, the 60s saw Holden, Ford, Chrysler erode the supremacy of the imported four-cylinder car and established the locally built six-cylinder models as the Australian motorist's premier vehicle of choice. Nonetheless, all the major British car manufacturers continued to sell their range of models in Australia and were joined in earnest by the Germans, the French, the Swedes, the Czechs and the Italians, who all cemented their place in the Australian market for a little slice of the action in the 60s. Of the continental European car makers, Mercedes and Volkswagen made the greatest impact in the 60s, as both had assembly plants and facilities in Australia, at Port Melbourne and at Clayton in metropolitan Melbourne. The Lanark Motor Group were appointed Volkswagen distributors for the state of New South Wales in 1954. And by 1957, this company, along with Regent Motors and other Australian shareholders, formed Volkswagen Australia, sort of a 49-51 partnership with the Volkswagen parent. The aim was full local manufacture. The first locally made panels were used in 1960, and full local manufacture was done at a new plant in Clayton in the southern Melbourne suburbs, and that was achieved by 1962. The Australian-made VW parts were identified by a kangaroo marking that was put next to the VW symbol when it was stamped on the part. The 100,000th Australian-delivered Volkswagen was produced in 1961. By 1962, Volkswagen was the third largest producer of cars in Australia, behind GM and Ford, and the 10th largest Volkswagen market in the world. Volkswagen purchased all Australian-held shares in the local subsidiary in 1963. The Type 2 Transporter and the Type 3 Volkswagens were assembled at the Clayton factory from CKD, or completely knocked down kits. The Volkswagen Dune Buggy was developed and manufactured at the same plant in Clayton. In 1968, Volkswagen ceased full manufacture in Australia and just reverted to total CKD assembly, which was sad, really. The plant and property were written off or sold to Nissan, who took over the Clayton factory buildings. Nissan, Volvo and later Mercedes-Benz trucks were assembled alongside Volkswagens from 1968 until 1976, when CKD assembly of Volkswagen ceased. So a lot of the Volvos that I sold, and some of the ones I owned, I suppose, were actually manufactured out of Clayton, out of CKD, completely knocked down pieces. So it wasn't fully manufactured here, but it was assembled here. By this time, 250,000 Volkswagens had been assembled in Australia. That's a bloody lot. Fiat began the decade with its 600 Bambino. its 1100 and its 1800 models and made a major push into the small car market in 65 with its 850 range and its all-new 124 series sedans and the coupes, and they're quite nice, the little coupes, followed by the sporty 125 sedan a year later. The smart-looking 128, a replacement for the 850, arrived in 1970, along with that six-cylinder 130 sedan, and also had a coupe. By then, Fiat and Lancia, now part of the Fiat Group, had both developed reputations as rust buckets, possibly because it made its cars from inferior steel that it purchased cheaply from Russia and began losing ground against the superior Japanese product that it was up against. Of the rest of the Europeans, BorgWarner went broke in 1961. Porsche developed its niche in the luxury sports car market with the famous, distinctive and durable 911 series. Volvo built its reputation as a staid but reliable, safe, boxy car with their 142, which was a two-door, its 144 and its 164 models. The cars I loved. They were introduced back in 1967, believe it or not. And Saab began to be taken seriously when it replaced the really strange-looking Saab 96, and wasn't that a strange-looking thing, with a 99 series in 1967. It's sort of like a car that all the accountants and engineers like to drive around in. BMW had tested the waters with its new class, introduced in 1962, but like Saab and Volvo, began taking things very seriously in and around 1968 with the introduction of the E-Series, from which BMW's current model range has evolved. Of the three major French players, Peugeot, Renault made the biggest inroads into the Australian market. In the 1960s, Renault Australia was set up out at Heidelberg in Melbourne. The factory would produce and assemble models from the R8, the R10, the R12, the R16, sporty R15, the R17 and coupes, and the R18, the R20. But then the company closed down in 1981, 21 years later. Renault sold its R4 and its R8, its R10 models from 1961 onwards, and replaced them with the popular R12. Now, that was a really popular little car in 1968. The larger R16 came out in 66 with its unusual liftback styling. It sort of developed a devoted following, I suppose, and all the oddballs. Interestingly, Renault Australia did not just concentrate on Renaults. They also built and marketed Peugeots out there. And Peugeot built itself a solid reputation, first with the 404 sedans and wagons that it introduced in 1960, which is based on the popular Pininfarina model shared with Fiat, the 1800s and the 2300s, and the Alfa Romeos, the Lancia Flamingos, or whatever they were, Flaminias, and the Austin Cambridge A60 and Freeways. So there's a little bit of bastardisation went on with the designers back then. Of the other French manufacturers, Citroën sold, but it didn't sell a lot of cars, the Palais and the 2CVs. Odd being much of the reference to the occasional sale, but the vehicle itself, which was somewhat odd. Simca's, now there's the Simca. Simca's became part of the Roots Group in 1958, and the deal with Chrysler in Australia, which had affiliations with the Roots Group, the Simca Aron, was assembled from CKD kits at their Keswick factory in Victoria. So, gee whiz, you know, when you look back there, we were trying to build things and put them together and everybody was out here trying to make a quid. The Simca Aron continued to be produced until 1964. And the very last Aron was built in Australia from existing leftover parts. That would have been an oddball thing, two headlights on one side and one on the other. How'd that happen? And speaking of oddball cars that are produced by mistake, I remember visiting General Motors' assembly plant out of Dandenong, and one of the supervisors said, look, I'll take you around the factory, use one of these little oddball cars, and up drove this, what would have been a Tirana, little four-cylinder Tirana, and back then they were available in four-door and two doors, and here it was, I hopped in one side of the car, which had two doors, passengers, one on the passenger side at a rear door, and he got in the driver's side, which had one door, no back door. And apparently, during the production phase, something happened, someone put the wrong panel in the wrong jig and it came down and no one asked a question. They went, oh, well, that's what the engineers want. So it was welded and then the trim came along and the trim guys went, oh, well, that's a bit odd, but don't ask any questions. So they put the right trim out of a four-door car on the left-hand side and the correct trim for a two-door car on the right-hand side. And so it went on until it got right through the whole production. And at the final stage, someone turned around and said, WTF, what is this? And it was never released, but gee whiz, you think about it today, I think there's a little Hyundai coupe that has two doors on one side and one door on the other. So maybe somebody saw that car out at General Motors years ago and thought, that's not a bad idea. Anyway, there's some stories for another time. And in my next podcast, we'll start it, I think, with the mini car revival. So look forward to talking to you then. Before I go, I'd also like to remind you that I have a website now, www.gordonmcleish.com. And you'll find some photos, some diagrams, some funny memes, and a link to some of these podcasts, as well as photos of adverts that people have been posting, and just some general bits and pieces that might be of interest to you. So that's www.gordonmcleish.com. Thanks for listening. Please rate, review, or subscribe to or follow this podcast on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm your host, Gordon McLeish, and thank you for listening. The Car Trade Revisited and its associated GordonMcLeish.com website has been compiled from a multitude of resources. Most of the editorial copy has been written by me over a number of decades and draws on my experiences when working in the auto industry in Australia and visiting its regions and towns and cities. Information provided and distributed by others has been added to my material, so as I give a more complete picture of what each decade has to offer to the listener. This was done over a period of time initially for my own personal use, and long before the decision was made to share my research with anyone interested in it via the medium of a podcast like this, or even on the internet. I do not claim ownership of this additional material and is published here for the benefit of the listener only and not for my personal gain or credit. Should this be considered as unauthorised use of any of the material, I'm happy to remove it or credit the source of the owner or mention the owner if this has not already been done. I researched a lot of the finer detail from manufacturers and distributors' websites, from Wikipedia.com and AustraliaForEveryone.com.